You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Greetings. I'm in Miami, Florida for the Republican debate coverage with CNN. And I'm in my hotel room, my glamorous hotel room at the airport. How are things in North DMZ?
North DMZ is it was practically summer yesterday. Spring. I think the groundhog was actually correct this year. Now that I have grade school children, I learn what actually happens to the groundhog. I don't pay attention to otherwise. Groundhog said early spring. We're getting early spring. Who knew?
And by the way, underrated movie. I think we could agree. Groundhog Day, Bill Murray.
I think that movie gets it. I think it's a brilliant movie. I think it gets what it deserves. I wouldn't say it's underrated.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I think it has been appreciated in recent years more. But I think at the time, probably, who would have thought that that movie could have very easily have just sort of receded with, I don't know, a movie like John Candy's Summer Rental or something that no one remembers. But right. Very nice movie.
Go on.
Oh, I was just going to say we are this will be an abridged DMZ. I know you got to jump, so we're gonna cover a lot of ground. I think in a short amount of time.
True, but I still need to make this one important Groundhog Day point. Excuse me. The last scene of Groundhog Day is clearly mailed in. When Bill Murray, walks out onto the sidewalk with Andy McDowell, and he turns to her and he just goes sort of, very ham-handedly, "Let's live here." And you're like, "Oh, okay, we're done here. Wrap it up. Let's go home."
What you find cynical, I find touching, Bill, but I may be more of a romantic than you are. So, so we got a debate tonight. Can't really talk about that. Won't be able to talk about that, obviously, because... because it's tonight, but we had the Michigan primaries happen. We've got Florida primaries coming up. Obviously, the debate tonight could impact that, but it's not looking good for your boy Rubio, Bill. It's looking bad.
For my boy Rubio. Well, I have a piece yesterday in the New Republic called "The Case for Shutting Down the Republican Party," premised on the notion. So whatever happens in the debate. Whatever happens in Florida, whatever happens in Ohio, I mean, I think we both agree that as it stands, as the polling stands, Trump is in the driver's seat. You're not getting – there's polling evidence to suggest that a one-on-one race, Trump would lose, at least to Rubio or Cruz, not necessarily Kasich. But we can't seem to get there fast enough to actually stop Trump from accumulating a majority of delegates. I mean, I suppose – you can't close it down just yet, but we're on the way. But even if you did stop Trump from getting the majority of the delegates, he would have a lot of delegates. And if he had the plurality of delegates and he was denied at the convention, his supporters would be livid and they would probably storm out and sit on their hands or go somewhere else in the general election. And if Trump gets the nomination, you have a whole bunch of conservatives already saying they're never Trump and not going to be with them during the election. So you seem a schism seems almost inevitable. And the point in my piece was that the Republican leadership and the conservative movement leadership should embrace this, should take this as an opportunity to say our coalition has always been premised on pandering to this bigoted strain in the American politic, which Trump is now demagoguing and pandering to get where he is today. It is not a tenable coalition long term in a demographically changing, increasingly diverse America. We know we got to kick these people to the curb at some point. Let's just do it now. Either we block them at the convention, or if they take over the party becomes useless. So we get rid of them by leaving and starting over from scratch somewhere else. And that probably means you lose 2016, but the polls today suggest you get hammered with Trump anyway. So look at it as the opportunity to cleanse this movement, cleanse the party, or start a new party with a clean slate, and be liberated from having to deal with these people, and get back to, you know, the Paul Ryan vision of actually proposing constructive ideas and building a party that can thrive in the 21st century that way. Obviously, coming from a liberal, this is going to be treated as a troll by many, but I don't know if you're willing to go as far as I'm going right now, but you certainly want it. You've always talked about modernization of the Republican Party. Is this the only way to get there?
Well, I would say a few things. One, as you I'm sure probably know, I would disagree with your premise that, you know, the Republican Party or conservatism has always been premised on tolerating, you know, this racist strain. So that's one thing. Secondly, I do agree, of course, with you that whether you're an individual or a party or a movement, you cannot abide racism, like either morally or ethically, or even just from a branding standpoint. Like if you can label somebody a racist, then you've effectively shut them down. Like it doesn't really matter what they say. They're discredited. And so I think that if you care about the conservative movement, you're by definition have to care about brand management and avoiding the stereotypes that that legit or not that are out there. And you have to be very vigilant about keeping that anything that might tarnish the great things about conservatism, which I believe actually bring about human flourishing and lift more people up, bring more people prosperity. So I agree with that. I would say I think it's certainly possible that we could have a reordering or even a breakup. I'm hoping that doesn't happen. And I think that there's a chance that an open convention could turn to Ted Cruz as a way to avoid Trump, but also placate the base that might otherwise be utterly outraged. And I think there's also a chance that Trump could somehow form a unity ticket with a John Kasich or a Marco Rubio or somebody to make him more palatable to mainstream conservatives and establishment Republicans and keep the party together that way coming out of the convention. If that's what happens, then they would still have to deal with the problem that you present, which would be that Trump tarnishing the brand of the Republican Party.
And people would still walk, right? I mean, there are people who have said they're never Trump no matter what. I mean, would a Kasich VP ameliorate that?
Oh, I think it could. I mean, ameliorate, not eliminate, but ameliorate. I think that it could. I think it could lessen the. I'll put it this way. People say it's easy to say I'm going to move to Canada. When push comes to shove, breaking up is hard to do. And it's possible that there are people who today say that they would have to leave. But if Trump changes his tune, if Trump pivots, if Trump picks a running mate that softens him or appeases them, then you could end up having people over time sort of buy into the argument that, look, Hillary Clinton, we cannot have another 4 years of this. And, you know, we just can't have those three or four liberal Supreme Court justice picks. We're just going to have to suck it up. And we may not like Trump, but we might have to just, you know, suck it up and deal with it.
Well, to go back to my original point now, I quoted you in my piece. I quoted Too Dumb to Fail in the piece. And I wanted to be careful because I know you wouldn't. I know you don't call these strains outright racist strains, but you did go as far as to call the influx of Southern evangelicals and the anti-Islamist strain in after 9/11 as ideological immigrants to the conservative movement, who have fed an anti-intellectual ethos to the party, which is, you know, sort of the premise of the book. And when you look at the polls today, there's an ABC Washington Post poll that came out a couple days ago when they ask Republicans, do you support a temporary ban on Muslims entering the country? You know, that I believe that was 52%. Do you support forcible deportation of all undocumented immigrants? That was at 55%. Forgive me if I'm switching the numbers, but they're basically around the same, a little bit above 50%. That's just cutting the party right down the middle. And, you know, I guess some people can, you know, rationalize and say, well, you know, they may hate immigrants. That doesn't mean they're racist. They may want to ban Muslims, but that doesn't mean that they're bigoted. You know, they just have, you know, sympathize with their national security concerns or sympathize with their with the plight of the white working class and the economic changes, blah, 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 blah. But obviously, there are legitimate fears of personal security and economic security that are legitimate. But to scapegoat people for that is not legitimate. I don't have a hesitation calling that strain bigoted. You may not want to use that phrase.
Here's my point. My point would be there is no doubt that I've said this before. Not all Trump supporters are racist, but all racists seem to be Trump supporters. I mean, there's no doubt that there is a strain on the right that is certainly manifested during this Trump zeitgeist that is racist. But what I would push back on is the note, because I think liberals want to discredit conservatism and the Republican Party and the Reagan era, and they want to cast a pall on it by assuming that, like, underneath, deep down, this was always premised on this Southern strategy and racism. And that is what I utterly reject, that was always sort of the Republican Party against the movement was always premised on that. But today, what we're seeing with Trump, clearly there is some minority of people out there who are bigots who are supporting Donald Trump. You cannot deny that. It's quite clear, including, you know, David Duke, who's endorsed Donald Trump.
So isn't it in the whether it's within the Republican Party or outside the Republican Party, for those who care about traditional Republican conservative values, would it be beneficial to embrace the confrontation, not patch it over with a unity ticket, but to have it out? Either kick them out of the party or leave the party and start over. Would that be positive for conservatism long term?
It's a really tough call, and it's, I hate to say it, but you know, we're talking about, there are two major parties in America, and the Republican Party has been in existence since the 1850s, and this is like getting divorced. It's a big deal. There's kids to worry about. There's a house to split. I mean, like, this should be like a last resort, and so as I am like completely on board with the notion that conservatism cannot allow it to be tarnished or tainted by the stain of racism, and you know that this is a hostile takeover that Donald Trump's engaged in, and all of that. But I also think that it might be easier for a liberal such as yourself, Bill, to kind of cavalierly suggest this, but if this happens, it could certainly bring about Hillary Clinton. It could bring about three Supreme Court justices, three or four in the next term, that could dramatically alter things for a generation. It could be irreparable. It's a big lift, and I don't think we should enter into it, you know, cavalierly. It's a huge conversation. And I mean, I just think Cleveland, this Republican convention, if it's an open convention, what an amazing story, an amazing time to cover. I mean, we are witnessing history right now. This does, you know, parties do not reorder all that often. I mean, the Reagan coalition that we have now has basically hung together, you know, for my whole lifetime. And parties, you know, the Democratic Party has obviously reordered many times, but it's had the same name, I think, going back to Thomas Jefferson, right? So that's a long time.
I do not downplay
breaking up is hard to do.
The severity of the recommendation, but it does strike me you're in a severe moment.
We are. We are. Desperate times call for desperate measures. And speaking of desperate times, since I am in Miami, since we are about to have a debate, and we don't know what's going to happen there, but Marco Rubio back against the wall. I think it's worth talking about this for a minute or two, Bill.
Yeah.
This is a guy I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you have said you voted for Rubio in the Virginia primary. You have
I would have voted with the caveat that I would have voted for Cruz if I lived in Texas.
Right. But you have talked about Rubio as the kind of conservative that is the future of the party, with an optimistic vision, proposing real policy solutions, not tethered to tropes of the past. And there was this fleeting moment after South Carolina and Jeb dropped out, where it seemed like he was getting that consolidation to be the Trump alternative, and then it all slipped away, and it seemed to slip away. I mean, people are sort of knocking him for getting into the gutter with Trump, but that happened because it was slipping away already. I mean, he was desperate to find some way to get back in the game because nothing else seemed to be. I mean, it's sort of like people blaming the Dean Scream of Iowa. That happened after he lost Iowa, so that wasn't the problem. The problem was before then.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. This is the guy who I think is the most talented conservative communicator I've seen since Ronald Reagan, and he will now likely. He can win Florida, but it's likely that he will lose Florida, and that it will be very embarrassing. And just to have a guy who's, again, I would say the most talented communicator since Reagan, be a year from now, not even have a Senate seat, be out of office, and go down embarrassingly in his own home state, is a great story. I mean, it's actually a great story from a journalistic standpoint, but it's unfathomable, and it's very depressing if you are a conservative. It's unbelievable what's happening.
Is there any sense from Floridians, from Florida Republicans, why this is so? I mean, I've had a sense for a while that there is a lack of home state loyalty to politicians. You know, we haven't seen...
Well, except in Texas. Don't mess with Texas. Right, I think Texas has that, but...
At the vice presidential level, for example, John Edwards didn't bring home North Carolina. Paul Ryan didn't bring in Wisconsin. New Jersey didn't seem to like that Chris Christie was even running for president. That cheerleading sense that your guy is making it to the big time, that doesn't seem to happen anymore. So is there just sort of a lack of interest in Rubio in Florida on that basis, that there's just not a deep bond there? Or is there more antipathy? Are Florida Republicans mad at Rubio because of the immigration bill that he tried to engineer? Or is Rubio a non-factor? It's just, hey, it's not you, Marco. We just love Trump. We're on the Trump train, and we just don't care about anything else.
I'd say all of the above. I don't think there's. I don't think, by and large, we have a mass media. I don't think we're as parochial as we used to be. I don't think that we have that same loyalty. I think Rubio's team, for as good as they are at communications and messaging, not great at building organizations or logistics, even here in their own home state. I think that Florida is incredibly transient, and there are a lot of people like Donald Trump who move down here every year, and a lot of people who die every year. Maybe Rubio can run up the numbers in South Florida. But by the way, let me just say, as an aside, Ted Cruz loves trolling Rubio and loves. I don't think this happened. Maybe I missed it, but I think Cruz should have sent his dad down to Little Havana to go to the Versailles restaurant and drink coffee and go to the Bay of Pigs and Memorial and like speak Spanish. And I mean, that would be the ultimate humiliation, is if Cruz could start peeling off, Cuban voters in Miami from Rubio. Again, it's a suicide, not a suicide mission, but Cruz's strategy, I don't think, is really to win Florida.
Cruz just wants to want to take Rubio out and make this one-on-one with Trump.
Right. which I think is actually a flawed strategy for Cruz. If I were Cruz, I would be helping Rubio win Florida to get those 99 delegates. But you know, I guess he figures you got to get rid of him now because if Rubio wins Florida, it's not like he's going to then drop out. He's going to keep going, and that would have impact him down the road. So it's crazy. It's crazy. And I mean, who would have thought that that Marco Rubio would be in dire, you know, danger of losing Florida?
So is Rubio a fundamentally flawed candidate because he was because the immigration debacle is the ultimate albatross? He doesn't have a feather in his cap of successful leadership in the Senate, and so nothing he could have done was going to save him? Or did he make an organizational strategic error? I mean, his team has seemed to downplay the need for, you know, nuts and bolts organization. They seem to be more interested in an air war, in a media strategy, do well at the debates, be telegenic, get media plaudits, and some people say they had a 3-2-1 plan, third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire, first in South Carolina, and then they would just magically take off from there. I've always been dismissive of a anti-organizational strategy. However, the person who has that strategy is Donald Trump.
Why not have messaging and an organization? And Donald Trump is unique, and I don't think the rules apply to him, obviously. But look, I'm actually writing a piece right now for the Daily Caller, Marco Rubio's five big mistakes or five big problems. So everything you said is true, but I think the fundamental problem is that Marco Rubio is an optimistic candidate in a pessimistic year. He is a candidate of hope and aspiration in a year that wants anger, and it's just the timing and the political environment.
But is that necessarily true? Couldn't the establishment have consolidated around one optimistic candidate early and bested Trump one-on-one?
I mean, it's possible if Rubio doesn't have that horrible debate in New Hampshire. He comes in second in New Hampshire. Jeb Bush and John Kasich drop out. Rubio wins South Carolina. I mean, you could always have hypotheticals. And so, yes, I think that, you know, Rubio, without that debate, maybe the establishment coalesces around him much earlier. And but again, the fundamental problem, I think, was that he was just he's a candidate that would have been amazing in a time when Republicans were looking, like, say, 2000, when compassionate conservatism really sold. Rubio would have been a great candidate in an era like that. And I'm hoping there will be another era like that again. But right now, when people are angry and frustrated and they want someone who they perceive as, like, equally angry, equally frustrated, who's going to fight for them, you can't beat Trump in that game.
I want to pivot to the Democrats in Michigan, but as an intermediary step, is the fact that Bernie won Michigan, despite being behind in the Real Clear Politics polling average of Michigan by 21 points, one of the biggest polling failures in history. Are Republicans, are Kasich and Rubio looking at that and saying, I can still win this. You can't trust these polls. The polls don't mean anything. I know my state. I know the future lies. I can gut this out. Are people making that connection that just the polls, because you can't trust them whatsoever?
Oh, yeah. They'll make that argument. And the question is whether or not it's spin. Do they really believe it? You know, the polls were pretty correct on the Republican side. In Michigan,
they're pretty correct overall. I mean,
yeah.
But some things have been sort of like, you know, Clinton in South Carolina was up by 20 points and she won by 50 points. So some people say that's a polling error, but at least it was directionally correct.
I mean, it is interesting. I don't want to like take a cheap shot here, but you know, what's his name? Nate Silver has been so wrong. He totally wrote off Donald Trump months. You know, for months. I think he said it was like, I forget the percentage, but like he totally missed Bernie winning Michigan too.
Well, I mean, cause the the polls plus forecast was he had less than a 1% chance of winning.
But
when your model is heavily based on polls and all the polls said one thing, of course it's going to be wrong.
Right, but when Republicans raised questions about the polling in 2012, now, Grant, I mean, they were called, like, you know, poll truthers, and the notion that the sampling might have been wrong was treated as almost like trutherism, where, you know, polls sometimes are wrong, and sometimes the sampling is rather, they're sort of undercounting certain people. I mean, I guess the problem for people like Rubio especially is that it seems like if the polls are wrong, they're wrong in terms of underestimating the kind of working working class white Rust Belt anger, you know what I mean? And you know, maybe people like who support Bernie and Trump, and by the way, I obviously do see a connection there, are less likely to have landlines or to respond to polls, or maybe they're just people, they don't have a record of having voted in past elections. I don't know why, but it may be that we're, when there is an error, it's an error in terms of underestimating the Bernie Trump vote, and not, it's not going to be something that might bring solace or comfort to Marco Rubio.
Well, I don't know. I don't think we know exactly what the Michigan failure was. What? Because this was not just one poll. This was many polls that had the same from different outlets. So presumably they didn't all make the same exact weighting error in the sampling. I mean, maybe they did. I don't know if that weighting error was on the white working class side or was it on the African American side, because Bernie did better with African Americans than he has in other states. But I think it is. And look, and the point is well taken that we shouldn't treat polls as gospel. Polls can be wrong, even if they're mostly not wrong. And there is an art to it in how do you weight the data that you have and trying to make an educated guess what the demographics of the turnout will be like. But yeah. I would think that you are more likely to have that kind of problem at a state primary level as opposed to a national election model, because you know, the primaries are inevitably lower turnout than the general election, and vagaries in intensity in a constituency are more likely to manifest in that circumstance than when you got 120 million people voting. You know, there's only so much crazy spikes of constituencies are going to happen when you're dealing with a population that large over the span of the entire country. But that's not really a cause for getting into poll trutherism and saying this is all a big conspiracy to screw us. It just caused to say, take polls with a grain of salt. You know, look at the data as it stands, see what the demographics are saying, and adjust your strategies accordingly to maximize your vote haul the best you can. But so certainly, you know, people shouldn't write anybody off based on poll numbers. We should be hesitant of doing that. But I don't think that's cause to say that, you know, sort of polling is broken and everything, and there's no point having them. It's just how you use them properly.
I concur, my friend.
Well, let's go a little bit deeper into on the Democratic side here, because, I mean, obviously, yeah, you're not following as closely as I am. But, you know, certainly in my Facebook feed, you know, I've written a number of pieces where I've essentially said Bernie's not going to be the nominee. The delegate math doesn't add up. And he needs to start, he and his supporters need to think about, you know, the next steps of how are you going to take the convention? How are you going to keep the revolution going after the convention? And winning Michigan is sort of making all of them say, you know what you're talking about. You're part of the establishment trying to keep Bernie down. This is all a big, this whole game is rigged. But what strikes me about that is, you know, Hillary won more delegates on March 8th, which is being treated as Hillary's spin, you know, denying the reality of the Bernie spike.
Well, that's the other thing, too, about Trump. I mean, I think he got, I mean, he's only getting like 40% of the delegates or something.
Right. And his delegate lead is relatively small.
Right. And if he's going to get 1,237 delegates in order to clinch the nomination and avoid a convention fight, he needs to be averaging something like 58% of the delegates here on out. So
which, the same thing with Trump. Take all states coming up, so he might accelerate rapidly.
Yeah, again, 99. He looks like he's got 99 delegates in Florida.
Right. So it's with the Democrats, they don't have any winner take alls. It's all proportional, so it's easier to game out where this goes from here. With the Republicans, there's more uncertainty with the winner take all stuff.
And of course, superdelegates that Republicans don't have.
Well, you know, the Bernie folks keep talking about superdelegates on the Democratic side, which Republicans don't have. Although Republicans do have two states where they had no presidential primary or caucus contest at all, and all those states' delegates go unbound. So it's Colorado and I think North Dakota. So you have a sort of de facto superdelegate pool in that respect. But that's a smaller pool than what Democrats have. But Democrats, the superdelegates are not Bernie's problem. Bernie's problem are pledge delegates. Bernie is losing by about 200 in the pledge delegate count. And because there are no winner-take-all states, it's very hard to catch up from that kind of deficit. Bernie won Michigan by 1.5%. And so he essentially splits the delegates with Hillary. He gets a small edge on that. Hillary beats Bernie by 60, 70 points in Mississippi, and she gets a lot of delegates out of that. So in a non-spin perspective, Hillary won the night because she got more delegates. The game is delegates. Now, you could make a spin argument that this is going to be a momentum shift for Bernie and he will then win more states in the future. And maybe that is true. But even if it is true, he has to win by so much to make up for the hole that he is in because he ceded the entire South to Hillary, and she racked up such huge margins there that the possibility of him doing that is nil. So I don't think that people are appreciating the fact that Bernie is simply not running a 50-state campaign. He is picking his spots. He's picking his spots well, for the most part. I mean, he came up short in Nevada, but he did what he needed to do in Iowa, New Hampshire, in Michigan, but beyond, and that's not to say he won't win more states in the future. I suspect that he will win some more states. It's just almost impossible to see how he wins enough states to actually win outright. And it's not spin on my part to say that. It's just looking at the numbers and the rules as they are. In the March 15 states. I mean, granted, we can't treat polls as sacrosanct, but her margins are, you know, she's got like a 15-point lead in Ohio and she's like a 30-point lead in Florida. Maybe Ohio's like Michigan and he'll turn that around. But to see him turning around in all five states, Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Missouri, and Illinois, that is extremely hard to see as it stands. If he swept all five, I'll be eating a lot of crow. But I don't expect that that's what's going to happen. I don't think it's crazy to say the person who is winning the most delegates is in the catbird seat.
No, I think you're right. I don't think you're going to be eating crow on this one. I think you're right. I think it's very, you know, it's very hard. Once on the Democratic side, especially, like once you get a lead, it's really hard to have, you know, it's very hard for an insurgent like Bernie to catch fire. Because again, you know, he had a huge night and Hillary got more delegates than he did. So
now the other part of this is to what extent does the Michigan loss show that Hillary is weak in the Rust Belt and weak with white working class?
Right.
You know, she's obviously getting on the strength.
Donald Trump would hit her exactly the same way that Bernie hits her in these debates. It would be the trade, coziness with Wall Street, bad deals, NAFTA. I mean, basically, it would be very similar in many ways.
Right. But here's my two points to undercut that argument. Number one, you can't look at at primary results and assume they translate into general election results. People said this about Barack Obama in 2008. He lost Ohio. He lost Pennsylvania. This must mean that the urbane, as you would say, city-fied, as you said in your book, candidate, you know, can't win with the lunch pail crowd.
Yeah.
But in the end, he won both states and won them both in 08 and 2012. So you can't.
Yeah, but he's running against. True, and I agree with you generally, but. It's one thing to beat John McCain and Mitt Romney, of all people, in Ohio.
Well, John McCain is not exactly a feat.
No, but he's not exactly Rick Santorum either. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that Trump would have, if Trump is the Republican nominee, that he would have a unique and special appeal in a place like Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Well, that's the current argument. But, you know, there was a great David Bernstein piece in Politico which points out that, you know, he needs to win 7 out of 10 white males in order to win a general election.
Doable. Don't you think that's doable?
I mean, it would break records. I mean, Mitt Romney won white working class 61-36, that is better, but in range of what the white working class has done in every election since 2000. That's the data I've looked. I've gone back last three, maybe four elections. But it's all. I think Bush Kerry was a similar spread, but Romney did a little bit better. So there's that argument that says there's only so much more he can get out of that population, and he's probably going to do worse with non-white voters and with women voters. So we already were talking about some conservatives, they're going to stay home or vote third party. So he's going to lose someone on his right flank there. So there's a whole lot of reasons why you can't just assume that he's just going to own the Rust Belt and make it impossible for Hillary to win. I mean, this is a guy in, you know, we had two polls come out this week, ABC Washington Post, Trump loses to Hillary by 9 points. NBC Wall Street Journal loses to Hillary by 13 points. There's no demographic way to win the right states while you're losing the popular vote by that much. That is a blowout loss. The only way to do it, and I have a piece in the queue that's not published that's going to talk about this. He'd have to do such an amazing pivot on several fronts to make up that kind of ground, to win what essentially he needs to do, needing to win 2-time Obama swing voters, swing state voters, to pull that off. So, that's the map for him. But you can't just say based on Hillary's primary result that is a fait accompli for him. There's a lot he needs to do to go from point A to point B.
Well, if anybody can pull it off, it might be the Donald, a political chameleon. So...
Well, I do need to jump, but do you have a last word that you want to say?
Go buy Too Dumb to Fail. It's not too late. In fact, it's as relevant as ever. So pick that up. And, you know, this is a wild time, man. The stakes are very serious, but for people who are political junkies, doesn't get much more interesting than this.
Always good to talk to you. Have a wonderful time in Miami.
There are worse places to be, my friend. So I'll hold down the fort here in South DMZ.
Deep South.
You got it.
All right, take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.